Now on Radio 4, Sarah Kestelman begins our new book at bedtime, Helen Dunmore's latest novel, The Betrayal, long-listed for this year's Man Booker Prize and the sequel to her bestseller, The Siege. It's 1952, 10 years after the siege of Leningrad, and Andrei and Anna's efforts to live good but unremarkable lives under Stalin are about to be undermined.
It's a fresh June morning without a trace of humidity, but Russoff is sweating. Sunlight from the hospital corridor's high window glints on his forehead. Andrei's attention sharpens. The man wants something, but he is afraid. Andrei Mikhailovich, I wanted to ask your advice if you've got a moment. As a diagnostician, there's no one whose opinion I respect more. Now, why is he saying that? Andrei's gift for diagnosis annoys him. The two men have never become friends. So what's the problem, Boris Ivanovich? Asks Andrei. Russoff glances down the corridor. Let's go outside for a breath of air. Two paths run crisscross through the courtyard. In its centre, there's a circle of gravel. Russoff's feet shift, crunching the gravel, as he takes out a packet of Primus and offers it to Andrei. Thank you. The business of lighting the cigarettes draws them close, but still Russoff won't come to the point, just keeps on dragging at his cigarette and blowing out jerky puffs, like a boy who's smoking for the first time, like Kolya. It's a new patient, a tricky case. One needs to be 100% certain. Andrei nods. What are your initial findings? Russoff gives a sudden, harsh bark of laughter. My initial findings are that this patient is the son of an extremely influential person. Ah, and how old is the boy? 10. And so it's a joint problem, is it? Is that why you've come to me? He's Volkov's son, says Russoff abruptly. Volkov's? Andrei's heart thuds. The Volkov, you mean? Russoff nods. A joint problem, yes. There's swelling and redness, pain on articulation. All the symptoms point to juvenile arthritis, and you're the man for that. The breeze is warm and sweet, but ice touches Andrei. There's much more here than he's being told. Russoff would do anything not to be the bearer of bad news to Volkov. It won't be Russoff's face that Volkov will remember with the cold, hard rage that such a man will feel for anything he can't control. You still haven't told me anything about this child, says Andrei. Russoff's eyes stare into Andrei's. My thinking was that it would be best for you to come to the case quite fresh. Hold back, thinks Andrei. Don't commit yourself. He recognizes it already as one of those moments that has the power to change everything. Andrei has Anna to think of, and Kolya. So you will see the boy? Asks Russoff. Not today. I've got two clinics and then a meeting until 9. I've got to go. My patient is waiting, and the radiographer. I'll speak to you tomorrow. Russoff puts a hand on Andrei's sleeve. I appreciate your cooperation. He wants to sound as a man should sound after a normal professional discussion with a colleague. But in spite of himself, his voice pleads. Andrei is on his way up to the ward when someone behind him calls his name. He turns. Lena, sorry, I'm in a rush. She's panting, and her face is flushed. I saw you coming out of radiology. I've got to talk to you. What's wrong? She glances up and down the corridor, puts a hand on his arm, and steers him a few meters away from the half-open door to their left. You were in the courtyard with Russoff. It's about the boy who came in last night, isn't it? Don't for God's sake let Russoff drag you into this. Lena, is it true that this is Volkov's boy? Yes. They say it's the only child. Andrei feels a plunge in his stomach, as if he were standing on a cliff and had suddenly looked down. But Lena, we're medics. It's perfectly legitimate for Russoff to call on a second opinion. He's going to be the first opinion, then? He's had X-rays done already. Did he tell you that? A wave of anger courses through Andrei. How can that be possible? To have x-rays done but not tell him? Lena, how do you know all these things? Because I've got kids. There's only me to look after them, and so I have to know things. Listen, we've been talking too long. A man like Volkov, you don't want him even to know your name. Call in sick tomorrow. Call in sick? If only he could. He's just an ordinary doctor. He wants to live out an ordinary, valuable life. He wants Anna and their life together. And Kolya, too, maddening as Kolya so often is. That child in his private room doesn't know it and can't help it. But he carries a disease that destroys ordinary life as fast as the plague corrupts a living body. His father is high up in the Ministry for State Security, and he has one of those names that is spoken only in whispers. Volkov. That's right. Heels against the wall, and now stand up as straight as you can. Anna is kneeling so that her eyes are level with little Vasya's. She is responsible for keeping the children's height and weight charts. When Vasya's gone, Irina pokes her head around the door. You finished in here, Anna. I'm off in a minute. Anna stands up. I've got a few last-minute measurements to put on the chart, and then I thought I'd stay on a bit to work out the averages. Well, if you will keep on showing a special interest. They both laugh. This is a favourite phrase of the nursery head, Larissa Nikolaevna Morozova. I have a new special interest in mind. Irina flicks Anna a look from under her lashes. I am making a full-time study of available men within the 25 to 45-year age group. You've done all right, Anna. You've got Andrei. Go on, tell me what you'll be doing on Saturday night. Anna laughs. Andrei is taking Kolya on a fishing trip, so I'm going to work on my dress. Oh, you mean the dress? Has he found out about it yet? No, and he's not going to until the evening of the hospital ball. You see, a perfect place for me to research my special subject, but it'll be you going. What a waste. Listen, when the ball is over, why don't you borrow the dress? You could go dancing. Irina has seen the fabric, a beautiful, soft, dark green glazed cotton. It was something from long ago which came out of a small travelling trunk that a theatre friend of Marina's had brought from Moscow. The trunk contained two parcels of material and a pair of red satin slippers, Marina slippers. Anna weighed them in her hand, thinking of the dead woman, her father's lover, who now lay with him in the same communal grave. There was a dress length of red silk in one of the parcels, but the colour was too striking. It would make her stand out. She would use the green cotton. Really? You're sure you wouldn't mind lending it? Irina was asking eagerly. Quite sure. Besides, we all have a duty to share the fruits of our special interest research with one another. She smiles, but Irina is looking over her shoulder. My own view exactly, Anna Mikhailovna. A wave of heat rushes through Anna's body, but long habit supports her. We were discussing the children's measurements, Larissa Nikolaevna. Excellent. I look forward to hearing your outcomes. Morozova is finished and perfect in her tailored skirt and jacket. She didn't live through the siege. Hard as life probably was for her, and Anna knows that she lost a brother, she has a kind of energy which Anna no longer possesses. All Anna wanted as those terrible months stretched out was to live, to put food into Kolya's mouth, to sit in the radiating heat of a lit stove. All these things seemed as remote as miracles. She'd lived so much with the dead that she had felt like one of them. Her father had lain frozen in the next room, waiting for Anna to come to him. Sometimes Anna feels a clench in her stomach, almost like fear, as if she's lost something she'll never be able to find again. Andre's different. He talks about Mikhail and Marina quite naturally, as if they died in the ordinary way. When Kolya was little, Andrei would tell him the story of how he first met your father. We were both in the People's Volunteers, and we used to sit round the fire and talk. And when Father was wounded, that's how you met Anna, Kolya would say triumphantly. His father had died, but Andrei had met his sister Anna, and now he lived with them. Most people thought they were his parents. It's a long time since she and Andrei talked about having children of their own. Towards the end of the war, they began to imagine it. Not only had they not died, but their children would be born and would survive them. Anna can hardly bear to think of all that now. She was 26, then 28, and then suddenly she was over 30. She can't talk to Andrei about it. She can't bear to bring her failure out into the open between them. The apartment seems many times larger when Kolya's not at home. Andrei takes a breath, feeling his lungs expand. It's so good to be alone with Anna for once, although, of course, he'll never say so. Did you have a good day? Anna says, as she spoons the last of the stew onto his plate. Quite good. Andrei crumbles bread into his stew. He's got to tell her. Anna, something happened today. She looks up, her eyes wide and searching. What? It might turn out to be nothing, but Rusov asked me to look at one of his patients. She says nothing, waiting. It's a child, a boy of 10. The father, he's MGB. Volkov.
Volkov? What's the matter with the child?
Rusov wouldn't tell me. He made out he had the usual symptoms of some form of juvenile arthritis.
It's something bad. That's why he doesn't want you to know.
It's hard not to come to that conclusion, says Andrei dryly. Anna's quiet for a moment. Then she says,
I should be thinking of the child, but I'm only thinking of you.
I was the same. As soon as Rusov told me, all I could think about was you and Kolya. In bed that night, they talk quietly, because they know that Kolya will be awake.
Andrei, why should you do this for Rusov? He wouldn't do it for you. Let's go away.
Go away? What do you mean? I can't leave the hospital. You can't leave the nursery. Besides, Kolya's got exams coming up.
I know all that, Andrei. But why not? We could go to the dacha.
People would see us coming and going. There'd be smoke from the chimney.
They're talking as if they really might do it, he thinks in amazement.
Go away, lie low, let the storm pass, lose their careers and their livelihoods, but keep their lives?
No, it's absurd. Anna is overreacting. Things are not as bad as they used to be. The terror is over.
It's impossible, says Andrei flatly.
Nothing's even happened yet.
Rusov's asked me to make an examination, that's all. If the boy's got arthritis, they can hardly blame the doctor.
But that's exactly what they will do. Rusov knows that.
We could go to Irkutsk. We could stay with your uncle.
That's just crazy, Anna. You're panicking.
We should panic. People are destroyed because they don't panic in time. They think it won't happen to them.
He feels her sigh become a shudder, shaking her body. Anna. Anna. He clasps her tighter, wrapping her in his arms. Her warmth and her softness surround him. Her body moves against his, yielding to his touch. They are moving out together, far from their creaking bed and the listening walls, to the place where they are always together and always safe.
Tomorrow, Andrei makes a decision as Sarah Kestelman continues reading The Betrayal by Helen Dunmore. It was abridged by Sally Marmion, and the producer was Di Spears.